This is the second session of an interview with Sam Jacobs for the University of Adelaide History on the 23rd of August 2007. So Sam, you and Badger became close in that sense.
Yeah, we did.
Yep, and the university began to see quite some growth in student numbers even in the late 60s. Would that be the result, or the Carmel report would have come out by then, I think,
yes,
wouldn't
it? Yes, oh, there was the earlier report in 1958 of the, what was that called, not the Baker report.
It was the Commonwealth report.
Commonwealth report in 1958, which predicted the future growth of the universities and so on. What the hell was the name of that man? I've forgotten his name. But anyway, so that was when Badger came. There were some very interesting financial developments in the ensuing years, apart from the advent of the Whitlam government, where they took over the whole responsibility for funding. And the universities became free, and of course there was an enormous growth and expansion, and we had to set up, Harry would know much more about this than I do, but we had to set up various committees to work out how to share the wealth and so on.
Yeah.
A thing called coordinating committee, where the faculties used to sort of sit around and find out how to share the wealth. Later on, of course, when Fraser became Prime Minister and there was a cutback, the same sort of committee had to decide how to wear the cuts and so on. But we had some interesting initiatives that I can't tell you the exact dates, but it was, I think, in the, what I'm thinking about now, I think was in the early 70s, I think, when one of the engineering professors, Sam Luxton, came to us with a plan to completely revamped the university's reticulated services, which he said were worn out of date, inefficient and wasteful. And he had a plan, and he set up, I think, with ESMG, the Engineering Services and Management Group, and they wanted to restructure the whole of the reticulated services and replace some of them, and they said it would save a lot of money and and increase efficiency. But he said it's going to cost us $1 million. Now, $1 million in the early 70s was the equivalent of somewhere between, what, $5 and $10 million now?
Oh, I think more.
More. It was a lot of money, anyway. But he said that we will save the university a lot of money. Well, we didn't have $1 million. So I went to see Rymal, who was chairman of the Bank of Adelaide.
Yes.
I didn't go and see the general manager, I went to see the chairman of the board, because I happened to know him anyway. And I said, the university wants to borrow $1 million. And I explained what it was for, and I said, you know, there's plenty of security, the university is solvent, we've got lots of assets, but not realisable assets, but our credit's good. And Rymal said, that's all right, and I'll approve it. And so we got $1 million, which we repaid out of a matter of years, out of the savings from the new, we repaid the principal and the interest out of the savings from the new system, which the ESMG had worked out for the university.
Now, when you say services, do you mean light and power?
Light and power and water. And a lot of the plant was pretty old and needed replacing, worn out. And I can't tell you the technicalities, but it was inefficient. And Sam Luxton, who was an engineer, said, we can do much better than this, but it would cost us a lot of money. So we did it. That worked very well. We also, around about that time in the 70s, we bought the CD700, which was then the biggest computer in Australia.
Yes.
It cost us $700,000. We had no money to do that either, but we sold its surplus capacity to business, to Commerce and Business, and paid for it by selling its the capacity which we didn't need. When I see all of this now, I remember we used to have to build a, I don't know about a soundproof, but an air-conditioned room to house this monstrous stuff.
And it was humidified too, if I remember.
That's right. Yeah.
I can still recall it.
So we took the initiative to buy that that big computer, which of course became obsolete in two or three. I think one of the great worries we had in the finance committee was that our computer man, Ovenston, I think was his name.
Ovenston. Yes.
And he wanted to get a new computer every two or three years because they were becoming obsolete. And they were obsolete by the time we got them, and it's a. But we managed somehow or other. And I suppose the other big expenditure we had to, or out of the usual expenditure, was when the future of the Elder Hall was an issue, and there was a great move. Dunstan was very instrumental, I think, in insisting on its preservation. But we had to get a new organ for it, and that cost a lot of money too. We shopped all around the world to get a new organ for the Elder Hall, eventually got one from Canada. But again, it cost a lot of money. So, you know, those were some of the interesting financial initiatives that we had to deal with. And it's
Sam, how did you cope with the building expansion in the late 60s through the 70s? Because there's the unions rebuilt, the...
The science and maths and all that.
Yeah, Hughes Plaza, then the Lidgettwood buildings created.
That's right. Well, that was all pretty well... That was all pretty well funded by the Commonwealth. It was pretty well funded by the Commonwealth. But some of those buildings were pretty horrible buildings. I mean, the Napier building's a horrible building, I think. And one of the other buildings, they were not exactly jerry-built, but they were not built to last. And some of them, of course, have become obsolete now. Mm. One has to remember that some of them were built 50 years ago. And it was
That's right. But I think the Union Building certainly standing the test of time.
Oh, yes.
But that seems to me to be in a different form than the Wills Building and all that area, which is a bit different.
Yeah.
But it's my memory of those years is a dramatic expansion in the form of the campus of the university.
Yes, it changed enormously. Mm. And there was some consternation because some of those buildings that took up what was thought to be important vacant space, that we ought to have a bit of breathing space in the university. But we really finished up a bit like the central business district with no open space at all much.
Did you find that those Whitlam years of expansion also caused problems when the Fraser years came, for instance? You mentioned the cutbacks. Was that a very difficult time?
Yes, it was. It was because we went from a period of rapid growth to a period of where you had to draw in your horns and find economies and cutbacks and so on, and it wasn't easy. It was quite a problem. It was largely managed. I mean, the finance committee would have set the financial parameters, but it was the academic community that had to work out how to operate within those parameters, and Harry could tell you much more about that than I could.
Because he was at the coalface, so to speak, having to live with it.
On the other interesting financial management issue that arose, of course, was the introduction of the new superannuation scheme, which was really a monumental task, because Harry was much involved in that because he was president of FAUSA at that stage. The existing scheme was all insurance based. They all had insurance policies, and the new scheme gave them defined benefits and so on. And it was a national scheme, but we had to woo people away. Some people wanted to remain on the old scheme. We couldn't force them to abandon it, but we had to sell the new scheme to the academic community, which took quite a bit of doing, but we succeeded. Harry can tell you more about that than I can too.
What were the relationships like generally between council and academics, Sam?
Um, It's hard to answer that because a lot of the academic decisions, I mean, they had to be approved by council, but they were worked out by these things like the coordinating committee and the other academic sort of subcommittees that were set up. And so the council didn't have a great deal to do with the academic decision making as such, except to approve it. But it was really worked out by the academic community, not by the council itself.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we had good vice chancellors, you see, because Strengths was a good vice chancellor, and he was a...
He was also a chemist, wasn't he, Don Strengths?
Yes, he was, yeah. But he had to really cope with the cutbacks. But he was his death was a tragedy for the university because we took a long time to find a new vice chancellor, a good one. I'm not even sure that I think they're all right now, but I think that I mean I like Kevin Marchbanks. He was a really nice, gentle, and a scholarly man, but he was really he didn't have the strength to guide the council at all, and he was not a great success as vice chancellor.
Whereas Don Strength had been, hadn't he?
Yes, yeah. And then of course after Marchbanks, I suppose we then got the woman,
Mary O'Kane.
Mary O'Kane.
Were you still on council then, sir?
No, I don't think I was. I retired from the council in 1994.
Yeah, she came a year later, if my memory's right.
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
So, but, so over your...
Certainly when I retired, that's right, Marchbanks was still Vice-Chancellor when I retired.
Mm. Sam, what are the largest changes you saw in the university over all the years that you've seen it? Would they have been physical mainly or more than that?
Certainly there were huge physical building developments. Well, in later years, some of the academic structures, they formed these sort of multidisciplinary departments and so on, which I thought was a bit of a tragedy. And so these multidisciplinary departments were in their own sort of internal management, were having to compare apples with pears all the time. And the law school particularly suffered. It lost its identity as a faculty, I think that some of those academic structures left a good bit to be desired. There were changes. I think the education committee became much more active and indeed interested in the financial management of the university, and that was a bit of a nuisance because they did not have all the necessary financial information available to them, and they were sort of making decisions as to where money should be spent without really knowing where the money was coming from. They really started to intrude on the role of the finance committee towards my latter part of my sojourn. I think I became a bit unpopular when I protested about that.
Sam, were there ever any major clashes on council as such that you can recall?
No, I can't. I mean, I'm not saying that there weren't, but I can't really recall any major fights that whether were, factions or anything of that on council. It's but I'd have to probe my memory a bit more before I could answer that with any authority. And I think that there were probably clashes lower down the administrative structures and so on. But I think by the time they reached council, there was generally a resolution in it. So I can't remember any significant fights on the council itself. It was
So, Sam, in those years you served, you would have seen a profound alteration from a state Commonwealth funding basis to the Whitlam era and the Commonwealth takeover of the funding, and to a very different university in effect, I suppose.
And I was always, in principle, while it was said to be beneficial to the university, but after all they were state universities, and when I first became involved, the state accepted some financial responsibility. And I always sort of felt that it would have been better if the state had been... the state never gave the university a penny after the Whitlam era. We got no state money at all. And it's, oh yes, there were some clashes, I think, not so much on council, but there were... I had a sort of an ongoing clash with Quirk, the director of the Waite Institute, because he thought that... that the Waite Institute was not getting a sufficient slice of the Commonwealth money, and when Peter Carmel became chairman of the University Commission, and he quite readily agreed, because he knew from his own experience that the Waite really was in a different position from the Faculty of Agricultural Science, was in a different position from other faculties. It had a very limited teaching role and a very huge research role, which was very expensive. And anyway, Peter Carmel, the University Commission, built into Adelaide's grant, we never quite knew how or what the basis of it was, but he did build into Adelaide's overall grant a financial recognition of the research responsibility of the Waite Institute. And Quirk always maintained that he never got as much as he was entitled to. And so I had an ongoing battle with Quirk over this. And that, in fact, got to the council, I think. And indeed, there was a Waite advisory committee was set up with Ken Williams as chairman. And he believed everything that Quirk told him for a long, long time, until he discovered that Quirk was misleading him, and as he indeed was trying to mislead me, but I wasn't to be misled, and so that really was a bit of an ongoing battle, which, but I'm not sure that it really was much ventilated in the council. I think the council was persuaded that the finance committee had got it right, and indeed, I had it informally from the university's commission, whatever it was then called, that we'd got it right. I mean, they didn't tell us what the basis of the funding was, but they said that we had got it about right. So I had that as my sort of fallback position, and that's a... But I could never persuade Quirk about that, and there was the Mitchell Committee was set up to investigate the future of the Waite Institute or something or other, and it came up with the recommendations, and including the funding recommendations, and Quirk wouldn't accept its findings either. He just thought he was being victimised or more. I believe he was quite a good agricultural scientist, but he was not a good director. But fortunately, his successor, short-lived as he was,
Harold Woolhouse.
He set it all to rights again. He really, and of course, at that stage, the Commonwealth itself said that the Waite Institute, like any other research institute, had to earn its keep. It had to be able to attract research grants from private industry and so on. And Woolhouse was very successful in doing that.
He was indeed. He was indeed.
Yeah, and it was also that he established a much firm a financial basis for the institute, which was no longer dependent upon this disputed allocation from the universities and from the universities commission, and so he repaired a lot of the damage that Quirk had done.
Sam, over the years, did you take note of the role of the law school at the university, or was your part at arm's length pretty much?
No, I was a member of the Faculty of Law for quite a long time, but I was really Well, I think at one stage I was the judge's nominee on the Faculty of Law, but I became a bit disillusioned with the Faculty of Law because it refused to have anything to do or take any advice from the practicing profession, and I thought that was very unwise. There were lots of people out in the profession that could have helped the law school academically, but they did not want any pseudo academics. They wanted only full time academics. They didn't, and it became a slightly unhappy place. It became very strongly feminist, which one can't, I suppose, it's politically correct to accept that, but it meant that a lot of the lacked leadership. People like Horst Lucker and Rogerson, they just threw their hands in the air and no longer had the quality of academic leadership that it should have had in its day. This is all part. I mean, this is one of the things where I always disagreed with Harry a bit. It was all a part of his concept of departmental government. I mean, it was a nonsense for there to be a law faculty and a law department. It was just because there was only, but then they were, meant that every academic had to sort of take his turn as head of the department, and some of them were good and some of them were very bad in it, so, and we were not getting the best, academic leadership.
So Sam, over the years though, do you feel that the university's held its place within South Australian society and culture, if that's the way of putting it? Because I was particularly thinking of the law school. There used to be a very strong interrelationship between profession and academic. And it seems to me that those, like you've described, those things have been strained at times and then come good.
Well, I think they're still strained, as a matter of fact, I would say. And I was not, although I was on the faculty, I was never, they wouldn't listen at one stage. When Bray, who was Chief Justice, came to a faculty meeting over some issue which he thought was important, I've forgotten what it was now, and they just wouldn't listen to him. And he was the Chief Justice and a very distinguished scholar in his own right. And these people just wouldn't listen to him. I think it's had a bit of a sad history in recent years, the law school. And then, of course, it wasn't improved and it became part of the palace, which I thought was an absolute disaster. Performing arts and law and architecture and economics. As I say, it was really a mixed basket. However, I think some of those changes were not for the best.
But in terms of, I'm thinking back now to the financial structure, there's obviously, from what you've told me, a vast improvement in the way that the finances were being handled.
Well, there was. I'm not sure what happened now. I don't know that. I think that, I'm not sure about Mary, but certainly de Crepigny didn't want a finance committee at all. He wanted to be his own finance committee. And I think that there was an element within the university that thought that the finance committee had too much power. Well, I can't really sort of comment on that. We did what we thought we had to do, and it's but I'm not sure now. And we had some pretty astute outside help on the finance committee too. We had some good people like Alan McGregor and so on, and these sort of people. You talk about the council. I know that that Walter Crocker became very disillusioned with the council. He was on it for a while, and he thought that it was all the time discussing matters of minimal importance and not dealing with the real issues of university government and education and so on. And I think he became very irritated with Harry, who was a bit of a stirrer and a special pleader. I have to say, it was at times a bit disruptive. I get on all right with Harry now, but I didn't always agree with him.
So, Sam, I'm just thinking that in terms of your involvement for the majority of your life, you actually kept touch with university in one way or another.
Oh yes, right up until the time that I retired, and indeed I found myself in a very difficult position when I became the Royal Commissioner into the State Bank, because the State Bank was the university's bankers. And I really had to disqualify myself from a lot of the discussions on the Finance Committee, although manage to somehow persuade them that they should stay with what was called the Good Bank, that really led to my retirement. It was a bit of a conflict of interest.
Sam, is there anything else you'd like to add at this point?
I don't think.
Well, can I just thank you very much for being interviewed today, and it's been a delight to hear something of your story.
Yes, it was an interesting time. I sometimes look back, I wonder how I managed to find the time to do it all, but particularly with my judicial duties, but I somehow managed to arrange it if the council was, or the finance committee was meeting, that I managed to free myself of court commitments and so on. Not always, but for the most part, I didn't miss many meetings. But I had a lot of other outside interests as well as the university. I suppose it's the old story that responsibilities tend to gravitate to those who are best able to carry them.
Well, thanks again.
Yeah.